Hey, this is Jeff Floyd, pastor of C3 Church Bathurst, and this is our podcast. Thank you for joining us today. C3 Bathurst brings life to people by helping them to be revived, restored, and released through getting to know Jesus and his people. We hope that this message will bring you life today.
What do you know about your family tree? We live in an era where it's easy to research our family tree, right? We get online and there's all sorts of websites and things. And a few of our kids, and we've been looking at my family tree. And, you know, my surname is Lloyd. And I'm associated with Lloyds of London and great wealth and background. But actually, when you start to dig around a little bit, interesting, my great-great-great-grandfather was Charles Lloyd. And he kind of appeared from nowhere. We know his mum's name, who was a convict on a ship. And then this guy, Charles, appears. And so it's a bit scandalous in the family tree. There's no Lloyds of London. You know, it's not great wealth. It's some convict girl on some slave ship who probably had some relationship with a guy called Charles somewhere. And maybe they just invented the name Lloyd. So there's my family tree. But somehow we long to find out our ancestry, don't we? We want to look back and go, well, where do we come from? What's in the closet? And sometimes when we open the closet, we'll just shut that one again, you know. And it's like that in God's family tree. And this is actually our story. Did you know that? This is the church's story. This is your story personally. And when you read about the kings and all the Old Testament things, it's actually our ancestry. And when we understand it and we know it, we get a greater sense of who we are and where we've come from. We're not just kind of here, but we've got a sense of lineage, and you and I actually have this lineage. And as we come to understand it more and more, we get a greater sense of who we are and who we're called to be. And that's really why I want you to understand the Old Testament. That's why we spent all this time this year exploring it in Bible college, and Bell's one of our Bible college students. Awesome job this morning, Bell. And we've just had so much fun this semester looking at the Old Testament and unpacking it. And what we're doing this month is giving you a brief 5-week overview of the Old Testament. Why? Because it's relevant for today. And this whole book is the Bible. It's all the Word of God. So we've been on a journey. First week we looked at the creation and how God created everything on purpose, intentionally, by the word of his mouth, from nothing. Different to when you and I create things. God creates something from nothing, including people as his best creation, as the epitome of his creation, individuals, people he loves. And yet it went south. You might know the story of Adam and Eve eating the fruit and disobeying God, and their eyes were open, and the whole of the universe went south. Like, sin, end of the world, death, decay. Not just people, relationships kind of suffered. And if you've ever had any problem in life, you can blame Adam and Eve. Really, you know, because that's not normal in heaven. It won't be like that. You will actually have peace and love and joy fulfilled. But until then, we have this kind of beautiful world, but it's just a little bit bent. And that's the paradox of life, isn't it? Paradox of any relationship or family or children or workplace. It's like, this is awesome, but we've got all these problems. Welcome to the world. Christ has the ultimate answer for that. But after that, we saw how God was reconnecting with people. In the garden, Adam would walk with God in the cool of the day, and they'd walk around and hang out together. But God doesn't leave us people alone. He longs to reach down and draw us back into relationship. And so God, I'm going to summarize this story on the screen. God calls a man called Abraham in Genesis 11, and he lives in this place called Ur. It's a great name. Of the Chaldeans, it is. He gets his family and they travel up to Haran. This is the Mediterranean Sea. This is the Middle East. This is kind of current modern-day Israel, Egypt. If you know geography, you've got some sense. Then here, God speaks to him. This is Genesis 11. And he says, go to a land that I will show you. And through your name, through your lineage, every nation on earth will be blessed. That's his promise. And so Abram does. He doesn't really know where he's going, but God shows him. He gets to this land here, modern-day Israel, and God says, this is the land. And walk around, and he does, and he becomes quite successful and prosperous. He has a couple of trips down to Egypt. But that's Abram's story. But Abram didn't have children. Miracle story of his birth to Isaac. Isaac gave birth to Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons who became the 12 tribes of Israel. And they became quite a big family of about 70 people. And then a famine hits this land, like harsh, severe. They have to get out. At this stage, one of Jacob's sons is living down in Egypt. That's an amazing story in itself, Joseph. And they end up, the 70 of them, in Egypt. Over here, they stay there for 400 years. And they, in that time, they become a mighty nation. The Egyptians eventually kick them out because they become too successful, or want to kick them out, or slavery. And Moses comes and rescues them from slavery, takes them across the Red Sea into the wilderness, this desert area here where they understand and get to know God's ways. It shouldn't have been 40 years, but it was. Could have taken 11 days journey, but they didn't believe in God's best for them. And so they spend this time wandering around, and then their children come back over here through Joshua, and they enter into the land, conquer the land, and they settle in there. The 12 tribes of Israel scattered around this land. And that's the first six books of the Bible, right? Just like that. You could be able to do that. You should have a great sense of your history and how that works, your family tree. So what I want to do now, that was the first six books. I want to cover most of the Old Testament today. It's about that much. Here we go. It's really quite simple. This is now the story of the kings of Israel and Judah. And the prophets and the people who spoke into the kings of Israel and Judah. That's it. That's the rest of the Old Testament with a little kind of postscript, which we'll deal with next week, which is a little journey into a place called Babylon. But let me summarize it for you. In fact, I'm not smart enough to do this. I found a great resource online that I'm going to show you, and it'll really just help you understand the deal with the kings. And I'm going to bring a few things out. Here we go, 4 minutes.
The books of 1 and 2 Kings, although they're two separate books in our Bibles, they were originally written as one book telling a unified story that continues on from the book of Samuel that came before it. So David has unified the tribes of Israel into a kingdom, and God promised that from his line would come a messianic king who would establish God's kingdom over the nations and fulfill the promises made to Abraham. So the book of Kings tells the story of the long line of kings that came after David, and none of them lived up to that promise. In fact, they run the nation of Israel right into the ground. The book is designed to have five main movements. The story begins and ends focus on Jerusalem, first with Solomon's reign and the construction of the temple, and then in this last section ending with Jerusalem's destruction and Israel's exile to Babylon. And the story leading up to this tragedy is what makes up the center three sections, which explain how Israel split into two rival kingdoms, how God tried to prevent the corruption of Israel by sending the prophets, and how exile became the unavoidable consequence of Israel's sin. The book opens with two chapters about the kingdom passing from the aging David to his son Solomon. And David's final words to Solomon, they're very similar to those of Moses and Joshua and Samuel to the people. It's a call to remain faithful to the commands of the covenant and to give allegiance to the God of Israel alone. But David's words ring somewhat hollow here, because David and Solomon then go on to conspire how they're going to consolidate this new kingdom through a whole series of political assassinations. It's not off to a great start. Solomon's brightest moment comes when he asks God for wisdom to lead Israel, and he even completes David's dream to make a temple for the God of Israel. Here the story actually stops and describes the design of this temple in detail, just like the tabernacle design in the Torah. There's all these gold and jewels and depictions of angels and fruit trees. It's all symbolism echoing back to the Garden of Eden. It's the place where heaven and earth meet, where God's presence dwells with his people. But no sooner does Solomon finish the temple that he makes some really horrible choices and the kingdom falls apart. He starts marrying the daughters of other kings, hundreds of them, for political alliances. And then he adopts their gods and introduces the worship of those gods into Israel. Solomon then accumulates huge amounts of wealth. He builds a huge army. He even institutes slave labor for all of his building projects. Now, if you go back to the Torah and look at God's guidelines for Israel's kings in Deuteronomy 17, Solomon is breaking every one. So by the time that he dies, Solomon resembles Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, more than he does his father David. The next section of the book opens with Solomon's son Rehoboam acting just like his father. It's a very sad story of greed and lust for power. He tries to increase taxes for slave labor. And under the leadership of Jeroboam, the northern tribes reject this. They rebel and secede and form their own rival kingdom. And so now in the story, you have the southern kingdom, Judah, centered in Jerusalem with kings from the line of David. And now this new northern kingdom called Israel, whose capital will be Samaria eventually. Jeroboam also goes on to build two new temples to compete with Solomon's temple in the south. He puts a golden calf in each one to represent the God of Israel. The connection to Exodus 32 and the golden calf, it's all quite explicit. From this point on, the story goes back and forth from north to south, tracing the fate of both kingdoms. Each one had about 20 successive kings, and as the author introduces each king, he evaluates their reign by a few criteria. Did they worship the God of Israel alone, or did they promote the worship of other gods? Did they deal with idolatry among the people? And did they remain faithful to the covenant like David, or do they become corrupt and unjust? And according to these criteria, the author finds no good kings in northern Israel, 0 for 20. And then in southern Judah, only 8 out of 20 get a positive rating, which connects to another huge purpose in this book, and that's to introduce the role of the prophets, key figures in Israel's history. So in the Bible, prophets were not fortune tellers. Rather, they spoke on behalf of the God of Israel, and they played the role of covenant watchdogs, which means they called out idolatry and injustice among the kings and the people. They were constantly reminding Israel of their calling to be a light to the nations, that they should obey the commands of the Torah, and so the prophets challenged Israel to repent and follow their God.
There you have it, the kings. We can finish right there. That's your family tree. That's Jesus' lineage. That's what goes way back. So I want to just spend some time drilling down in some of the detail of some of those kings. But I want to start in Deuteronomy 17, just briefly mentioned there. And Deuteronomy it's actually a massive lecture that God gave to his people before they entered into their promised land. Like he sat down the whole nation and said, right, listen up. If you want to succeed in life, this is how it's going to be. That's Deuteronomy. It's an amazing book. And he gives the guidelines and instructions for what they're going to be like. And in the middle of that, before they cross over into that land, he says, now, about future kings. He says, let me give you some wisdom. And this is what he said. 14, when you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it and then say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations around me. You may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. God is going to be the one who chooses the king. And he says, choose one from among your brothers, not a foreigner. Don't import a king from somewhere else. Get somebody who is your kin, your brother in Israel. And then he says, verse 16, he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. What's the deal with horses? Well, I reckon today's version would be nuclear weapons. It's just a show of strength. Military prowess. Just don't need all that stuff because you've got me. Don't put your dependency on military arsenal or horses in those days, chariots. No, I am your God. I'm the one who'll protect you and fight for you. And then he says, and he shall not acquire many wives for himself. You know, we're talking about political alliances often. Lest his heart turn away, and nor shall he require for himself excessive silver and gold. Don't be like the other kings who acquire huge amounts of resources for their own strength and pride and glory. An Israelite king is not supposed to be like that, because your boast, your wealth is in heaven. And then he sits on the throne. I love this part, verse 18. He shall write for himself a copy of the law approved by Levitical priests. He is to handwrite for himself the law. Copy it down. No photocopies, no printers. The king himself will handwrite this thing, and it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and statutes and by doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he might not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right or to the left, that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. Isn't that incredible? A blueprint for how to be a good king in the days to come. It's right there. It's written down for them that they may have a long and successful reign. The problem was, as we just saw, only 8 out of 40 managed that. The rest of them got pretty ordinary. But I want to look at just the overview to try and explain the link between the prophets and the kings and what their role was. There's another diagram just on the screen. Now, this, you can see, is the start. He's Saul, the first king. Here's David, who was not related to Saul but came in. David's son is Solomon. And you can see right after we've got the northern kingdom, all the kings, Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Elam, Zimri, Omri, Ahab, Uzziah, etc. There's some big words I won't say right now. And the southern kings, Rehoboam, Ahijam, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, Ahaziah, all the other ones. See, 20. Now that the northern kingdom was the 10 northernmost tribes, the southern kingdom was 2 tribes. This is the line here from David. And what happens? Eventually they get carted away to Assyria. Eventually they get carted away to Babylon. It's a sorry end. We're going to look at that next week, of what that all means. But what I want you to see is, as you read through your Bible, you come across the prophets. It's a huge chunk of the Old Testament. You've heard of Isaiah and Ezekiel and Joel and all these people, Zephaniah, Habakkuk, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Malachi. But you can understand that these prophets were speaking into particular kings, particular contexts. So if you read Joel, understand that he was talking to Jehoshaphat in the southern kingdom about what was going on there. If you read Nahum, understand that he's talking about the end of the northern kingdom. If you read Haggai, you understand he's right back dealing with right at the end of rebuilding the temple. So really, the chunk of the Old Testament is given to the history of these kings, whether they were good or bad, and the prophets who spoke into them and encouraged them to stay faithful to God and to do well. But the other thing the prophets also spoke about was the future. They didn't just speak to the kings and say, hey, you need to lift your game here, or why are you doing that? Also spoke, all of them, about a coming king, someone who was going to surpass all these kings. It's a beautiful thing. Just in all of these prophets, you see hints of the future. They all saw something beyond the here and now. We'll get to that soon. So I thought, let's look at a good king and let's look at a bad king to give you some context and some idea. Probably the greatest king was King David. King David was the king who managed to capture the hearts of his people and of God more than any other king. He started as a shepherd boy. He was the 7th son of a guy called Jesse. He was a shepherd boy, and in those days, it's not just cute with the sheep. You're out there at night. There's no fences. You're the protector of the sheep. You have to guard them against lions and bears and things. You wouldn't get much sleep. You would smell, you know, like sheep dung. You know, you're kind of out there, and that's how they considered David. Oh, he's the, oh, David. Oh, yes. Well, he's out with flocks. You don't want to know David. And so when the prophet Samuel comes to anoint the king, all of his older brothers are standing there going, surely it's me. Surely it's me. No. No. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And Samuel goes, he has the right family, right? He goes, aren't you sure there's someone else? Ah, yes. But you don't want to know. David! So they call him, and as soon as Samuel sees him, he goes, right, this is what he says in 1 Samuel 16. One of the young men answered, behold, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite. He's skillful in playing. He's a musician. He's a man of valor, a man of war. He's prudent in speech, a man of good presence, and the Lord is with him. He's the guy. He's been out tending the sheep, singing songs, composing things with his harp. He's got this incredible connection with God that when they look at him, they go, oh, God's with this. He's with him. He's been able to develop his strength fighting off animals. He's got good presence. He's got good character. This man was brought from tending sheep to actually looking after the whole of Israel. And there are some strong parallels there. He became a very successful king. So successful, in fact, that he could get anything he wanted. And he wasn't perfect. And you probably know the story of him and Bathsheba when one day in the spring year in 2 Samuel 11, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent his army out, but he stayed at home. This looks like fun. And it happened late one afternoon that when he arose from his couch, he's having a doze while his army's out there. He wanders over to the roof of the king's house and saw from a roof a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful. Instead of turning away, he goes, hey, servant, go and inquire after that woman. Who is she? Well, she's Bathsheba. She's married. Bring her over here. She sleeps with Bathsheba. He sleeps with Bathsheba. Have a son. He murders a husband and tries to cover up the whole thing. And I tell you this because he's the finest king. He's the king who gets the best rap, and even he falls. Even he is blemished, you know? And yet God forgives him, and yet God raises him up again, and he repents, and he writes Psalm 51 as a kind of sorry to God. And what I love about this story is that God sticks with his family tree. Like years ago, if it was me, I probably would have just said, forget it. If I was God, these humans, these people, and this family, you know, Abram's family, there's so much hard work. They're all doing the wrong things. They're all disobeying me. They're all doing that. And that's the history of the Old Testament, is God trying to connect with his people, God trying to lead them out of their own selfishness, but often failing, yet God continually reaching out and drawing them back up. And it's through kings like David that you see a great sense of God's love for his people. And there were some other good kings, Hezekiah, people like that, who stood up for God's things and his ways. And yet there were some horrible kings. I mean, not just kind of didn't do, but did really evil, foul things. Manasseh is probably touted as the worst. And we read about him in 2 Kings 21. He was only 12 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hephzibah. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. This is how kings work. Here's the king. Here's how old when he was born, when he became a king. Here's how long he reigned. And we get the thumbs up or the thumbs down. He gets the thumbs down. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. According to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. He started to bring in practices that all the other nations around them were doing. He rebuilt the high places that Hezekiah, his father, had destroyed. Hezekiah was a great king, a great reformer. He pulled down all the idol worships and places, but son, Manasseh says, oh, we should rebuild those. Yeah, maybe they'll help us. Trusting not in God, but in all these strange gods. He erected altars for Baal and made an Asherah, as Ahab, king of Israel, had done. And he worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. And he built altars in the house of the Lord. Get that? Altars, like the house, the temple of God was the place where God lived on earth. The presence of God was in the middle of this temple. It was a holy place, a place where they would come every year and worship God. And yet this king built altars to a foreign god in the middle of this place. It'd be like me putting a big Buddha here. Say, well, maybe we should have a bit of Buddha as well. Maybe have a bit of something else and a few other gods and a few little places where we could. Like, it would be hideous, wouldn't it? That's what he did. Burnt his son as an offering. My goodness. And used fortune-telling and omens. Instead of talking to God, he talked to tarot card readers and he did seances and, you know, kind of tea leaf reading, fortune-telling, and dealt with mediums and necromancers. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. This man, Manasseh, is part of the family that you and I inherit. Ouch. I'm going to get some users to help me. It's going to end in disaster. And as you read through the Kings, it's kind of depressing. Don't not read it because I told you it was depressing. But you get a little tired, and you find, I find when I read it, I go, come on, you can do this, young king. No. And you get to the next thing, come on, maybe this guy's going to, no. And you sort of get, I bet that's what God was like. And through the prophets, he'd write to these kings, he'd go, king, come on, lift your game, look up. But it leaves us with huge question marks. And in fact, if we only had the Old Testament, it's kind of depressing because you're just left with this story of despair. It's real. It's raw. It's not trying to sugarcoat it. It's very, very real. But we're left with this ache for something more. Surely this isn't the end of the story. Surely there's something else. Like, what is the point of creating a nation that's unfaithful to God? What is the point of just watching humans fall again and again, even the best of them fall over? What is the point? It says to me that religion doesn't work. Trying to follow rules and rituals, it just doesn't work. There has to be something else. There has to be another way. And the prophets, they tried, but what the prophets saw, what they started to speak about, was a new king, a new kind of king. It was different to all his earthly kings. He started to imagine and see a king who loves his people above his own life. Imagine a king who has absolute power, but yet uses his own power for the blessing of others, not himself. Imagine a king who has complete control and authority. Started to see this. Imagine a king who's able to engage in a crisis head on and not pander around it. Imagine a king who is full of humility, not self-promoting, not even concerned about his own appearance or his wealth or how he came across, but was more interested in the needs of others. Imagine a king who proclaimed a very simple and clear message and made it easy for other people to follow him. Imagine a king who would teach with great authority and wisdom, so much so that people would flock from countries around and come and listen to him and do without food just to hear the sound of his voice. Can you imagine a king like that? Imagine a king who was a team builder, someone who equips other people more than himself to fulfill a worldwide mission. Imagine a king who defined greatness by how well they served other people. Imagine a king who modeled servant leadership and not just talked about it. Imagine a king who was a relationship builder and a defender of people and their weakness. Imagine a king who always walked in integrity and in justice and never put a foot wrong. Imagine a king who could be tempted in every way and yet did not succumb to any temptation. Imagine a king who loved and promoted the care of the poor and yet held personal responsibility as genuinely needed. Imagine a king who valued personal freedom so highly that he was okay if people didn't follow him because he wanted free will. Imagine a king who did not ridicule or gossip or do underhand deals. Imagine a king who ruled by kindness, yet has final authority over everything, and a king who would be a judge of all. Do you know this king is real? Joshua says, "Choose this day whom you will serve." Through all the ups and downs of the kings of Israel and Judah, we ache for something more. We ache for a better solution. And they hint at it. But his name is Jesus. And Jesus came to fulfill all the longings of the people. He came to fulfill all the prophecies of what was spoken about. And we'll talk about that a little next month. I think Christmas has something to do with it. But he is the gold standard of leadership. He is the one who is far better than any earthly king or president or prime minister or ruler. He is the one who we can actually choose to follow. What king gives you the choice to follow him? Most kings will try and take over places. But this king says, come after me if you like. No pressure. Come follow me and I'll teach you, I'll guide you, I'll comfort you. He's a king like no other. He's a kingdom of freedom. His name is Jesus. And he's a king worth following. That's what the Old Testament looks forward to. He's the one who's going to end the wild ride of the kings and fulfill every promise. And you know, this morning you can follow him too. If you're not a follower of Jesus the King, it's actually really simple because he has already made it possible. You don't have to be of royal birth. You don't have to be in a particular country or nation. You don't have to be a man or a woman or, you know, old or young. It just doesn't matter. His invitation to us is the same. Come, follow me. Come, follow me. And that response of the heart will take us deep into his kingdom. And then we inherit his kingdom. But then he gets us and he'll set us as rulers to rule and reign with Christ. That's our destiny as followers of the real King. He gives us that privilege of reigning with him. And he gives us every blessing and every privilege in heaven. I tell you, it's going to be awesome for those who follow the King. And even on this world, we have glimpses and hopes of what's in heaven. Is he your boss? Is he your ruler? Have you given him allegiance? Or are you holding out on him? Let me tell you, there's nothing to hold out on. There's nothing, no reason not to follow this king. He's made a way for you. He's died for you. He's dealt with every problem you ever had. He's disconnected the power of sin and death. Unplugged it. there is nothing that will ever stop you from following this king. Even if you stumble and fall yourself, it doesn't matter. Our king has solved the problem. If you're not following this king and would like to, this is why we exist as a church, is to help people follow Jesus. And it's the greatest adventure you will ever come across. This morning might just be your entry point to this journey. I want to ask you sincerely, do you know this king? Do you follow Jesus? If you don't, would you like to today? Would you like to step on board? Start a journey of greatness. If that's you, just slip your hand up. I want to pray for you right now and connect with you during the week. And those of you watching the recording here, same thing. Anyone just want to step on, follow this incredible king? Jesus, pray for each person right now. We would be radical followers of the King of Kings. And we thank you, Lord Jesus, for your greatness, because you are worthy to be worshipped. Hey, thanks for joining us today. We'd love to get to know you better. Come and visit us at one of our Sunday services in Bathurst, rear of 217 Howard Street. Have a week filled with life.